The molecular basis of nervous system function, synaptic modulation, neurotransmitter secretion, gene regulation, and protein trafficking. That's a pretty heady list of research topics with an important goal to better understand things like multiple sclerosis, drug addiction, autism, and stroke. Dr. Mark Freeman is the incoming director and senior scientist at the Volum Institute. One of his areas of study is glial cell biology and their relation to disease. He joins us this morning. Good morning, Dr. Freeman.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. Please call me Mark.
All right, Mark. Yes. Tell us a little bit about the Volum and the work that is done there.
I'm happy to. So the Volum Institute is something that Portland and the whole state of Oregon should be very proud of. It's very well known throughout the world as a center of excellence for neuroscience research. One of the things that was so exciting to me, and one of the reasons I'm the incoming director and was excited enough to come, is that it is an amazing group of faculty that are at the Volum who have made really groundbreaking discoveries in how synaptic connections in particular, so the small connections between nerve cells and the brain, function, how they're modulated in different brain states, and how these processes are affected in disease.
Will your work there as the director, will that take away from some of your own research that you're interested in?
Well, I hope not, but directors tend to have a lot of work they need to do that pulls them away from the lab. That said, though, I'm a vice chair of a department now, so I have a certain amount of administrative role already. Part of the goal, though, for the director, and one of the expectations of the director of the Volum, which, and I think this is great, is that you lead by example and you lead an outstanding research group, because that is really the mission of the Volum is to do outstanding basic neuroscience research. So at some level, I'm sure that will be true, but the vast majority of my time, I think, will still be spent doing basic research.
And tell us a little bit about the research that you're specifically interested in.
Sure. Well, there's two main things that we work on. One that you mentioned in the introduction is glial cells, and these are sort of the Rodney Dangerfield of the nervous system, right? They have, if you ask people what neurons are, almost everyone knows, and if you ask people what glial cells are, you get a variety of answers. My favorite of all time is aren't those the cells in the brain that aren't exciting? And the person who said that was actually my mother. So after I picked myself up off the floor, I explained to her, glial cells are actually really fascinating cell type. They make up over half of the cells in our brain. And we're now learning that while neurons are the ones that fire and sort of drive signals through the brain and are probably the primary thinking cell, that they couldn't survive, function, and do many of the things they do without glial cells. And so one of the missions of my lab's work is to understand at a very basic level what these cells do. And the striking thing is that despite the fact that these are about half the cells in our brain, we know very little about what they do. So that's obviously a problem. We need to fix that. The other line of research we study is how the brain maintains its integrity over time. So this would be more relative to neurodegenerative disease. I'm sure many of your listeners know that one of the things that happens in every neurodegenerative disease is that connections between neurons, either synapses or the long fibers called axons, break, and that essentially unplugs that neuron from the circuit. And when patients lose function, that's essentially them losing more and more connections over time. So my lab also studies how that disassembly takes place. We try to find ways to block that from happening. And then when we identify pathways that are involved, we try to design drugs to block those.
Join our conversation this morning, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. I have a really broad question that's probably hard to answer, but where are we on brain research? It seems like such a complicated topic. Are we making some pretty good progress, or is there still a long way to go?
Well, there is a long way to go, but I truly believe that this is maybe one of the most exciting times to be in neuroscience research. In recent years, a number of things have happened that have facilitated our ability to look into brain function. So a few of those things include our ability to actually control neurons. So, for example, there are tools now which allow you to turn a neuron on or off just by shining the right color light at it. And there are also new methods for us to use optical illumination of neurons, or you just visualize neurons and you can just watch them fire. So we can not only now control circuits, we can image very large groups of neurons and watch them work together and begin to understand how that complex firing leads to eventually output from that circuit and ultimately behavior. So we have an enormous challenge. I mean, the brain is the most complicated and mysterious organ in our body. To claim that we know, for instance, how memories form would be unfair. We understand quite a bit about the changes that go on that we think solidify memories in the brain, where they're stored, how they're made, how consciousness arises from the brain. Those are all things that are well in our future. But the new tools that have come along that allow us to get in and manipulate circuits and see what happens, I think are really going to facilitate that. So the next couple decades in neuroscience research are going to be very exciting.
What does it mean for a neuron to be on or off? Is that similar to the kind of process that you see in a home computer where the electricity is either on or off?
So all of the neurons in your brain are, I would say, you should generally consider them to be on, but they don't always what's called fire. So the idea is that, when I said just a moment ago on or off, or we can cause neurons to fire or not, and then we can watch them fire or not. So you can think of the brain as a really sophisticated computer, and the way information flows through your brain is through connections between the neurons and information flow down certain circuits. So most neurons will always be sort of on and prepared to fire, but only fire at certain times. And when I say we can watch them fire, we can watch that activity take place. So on is was probably the wrong word. Active would maybe be a better one.
Okay.
Actively firing.
Does your research, is it tied specifically to a treatment, or are you looking at something that's more generically, and then after that, maybe somebody will take that information and try to develop a treatment?
Yeah, this is an excellent question, and it really gets to the heart of where is neuroscience going. And there's really at least two ways that people will do research. One is basic research, like at the Volum Institute, where we really try to understand, at its most basic level, how does the nervous system work? And that could be just trying to understand how a chemical released from one neuron to another neuron drives that signaling event and allows communication between just those two neurons. That's called basic research. And then there's translational research, which is more oriented towards seeing what happens in patients and trying to understand the underlying problems and correcting those with the appropriate therapeutic approach. OHSU is one of the reasons it's, I think, going to be an exciting place to be, and is an exciting place to be, is they understand that, you know, there's neither one of those two subdisciplines is going to solve any problem on its own. You really need to do both. When a basic scientist studies very simple events in nervous system signaling, almost invariably, we later find that those signaling events are important for disease. Because many diseases, as we know now from some of the pioneering work of the people at the Volum and other institutes, many diseases result from defects in synaptic function, in expression of genes in the nervous system. So I would say that research in neuroscience is going to require both the basic aspect, and that is primarily where I would be in trying to understand the basic function of the nervous system, as would many of the Volum people. But that would then be coupled with additional research from more translational colleagues who would then try to use that information to understand the basis of human disease. I think a great example is very recently another technique that's come along that has really transformed the field of human genetics is whole genome sequencing. So you can now sequence the genome of a patient, and if they have a genetic disease and you can get some of their family members, you can very quickly now narrow down the identity of the gene that is broken that is very likely underlying that disease. So when those discoveries are made, one of the first things that happens is that clinician would go to a basic scientist and say, what is this gene and how does it work? And then we would try to tease apart the basic mechanism, and in doing so, we'd give them some insight into how perhaps the disease was being caused.
Join our discussion this morning on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760. If you have a question about how your brain works or perhaps the brain of someone you love, or you could give us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. I was wondering what kind of challenges you face as you try to research the brain. Are there particular things that are just a stumbling block that you can't get past at this point in time?
There are. So one of the problems that we will face is, in the long run, ultimately, what we hope to use is the knowledge of basic research coupled with translational science to, you know, alleviate suffering in patients that are experiencing a disease or some other neurological conditions. A challenge is going to be, you know, delivery of therapeutics to the brain. One of the things about the brain that makes it so stable is that it's a fairly privileged area. It's hard to get things in and out of the brain because we have a multi-layered protective mechanism that surrounds it. So the delivery of therapeutics to the brain is going to be a challenge. There are examples of things that work tremendously well. There are other examples where it has been more difficult. But for me, I think that's going to be one of the biggest issues. Another issue will be understanding when a disease happens. So I'm sure you're familiar with neurodevelopmental disorders. These are disorders like autism spectrum disorders and schizophrenia and potentially some other neurological disorders where patients develop over time increasing symptoms. And one of the challenges that we need to deal with, it's going to be a difficult one, is even if we could understand, down to the molecule exactly how that disease works, if we needed to treat that patient 5 years ago or 10 years ago to really see a difference, how do we overcome that challenge? These are all sort of deep challenges that we're going to face in the future, but, you know, there's hope. There are many, many new methods for delivery of gene therapy or small molecules that are being worked on. That will hopefully overcome those.
This gene therapy that you speak of, is it any harder or easier when you're dealing with the brain compared to other organs in the body?
Absolutely, yeah. So there's, first of all, you only have one brain. It won't regrow, and the fear of doing anything detrimental is strong. And there are other systems in your body where you can replace the entire system. So, for example, you can get a bone marrow transplant and replace much of your hematopoietic system, blood system. So it does present a greater challenge. But there are, there's reason for hope. There are certain molecules that the brain likes to take up, certain complex saccharides or other molecules that one can couple drugs to that then get them across the blood-brain barrier. There are also some viral delivery methods. These are all in very early stages of development, but there's promise, and there's certainly, because we're all living older and asking our brains to stay functional for much longer, the incidence of neurological disorders, especially late in life, it just continues to increase. In fact, age is one of the greatest factors that predisposes someone to neurodegenerative disease. So this is something we need to work on. This is something we definitely need to solve.
So we're seeing an increase in some of these particular diseases simply by longevity.
This is a belief, yes. It's thought to be the case. So the numbers are actually, 1 in 3 people that will get cancer. And somewhere around 1 in 4 will at some point experience a neurological condition in their lives. Hmm. So it's, I think it's more predominant than people might appreciate.
We have a question from Jean in Winston. Go ahead, Jean.
Yes, that was what a fascinating program. Well, I've always thought it was kind of strange that neurology pretty much ignored glial cells except for their role as a supporting matrix. And I wondered, what are the interactions between glial cells and neurons, like mechanical and chemical and maybe electromagnetic? And what is the effect of electromagnetic fields on glial cells? Thank you.
Sure. So this is a person after my own heart. So I am one of the reasons I think that glia were not studied more is because when we started to study the brain, there were ways in which we could take neurons, put them in a dish, and record from them, and we could watch their electrical activity. So we could actually measure things and change things. That's not true of glial cells, and in fact, they change quite dramatically when you take them and put them in a dish. You really need to study them in the intact animal. So that's one of the explanations, I think, for their the fact they've been studied less. They are intimate, I believe, and we're gaining evidence on this now, that they are intimately involved in all aspects of nervous system development and function. So there's really beautiful evidence now that glial cells, in particular a subtype called the astrocyte, is very important for just the formation of synaptic connections in your brain, so the connections between those neurons. If you eliminate glial cells or remove specific factors, you get far fewer synapses made. That's important because it suggests that when you're wiring your nervous system, which you know starts when you're born and continues into almost your 20s, glial cells are probably regulating which connections get made. It's also likely that they're important during plasticity, what's called plasticity. So when you form a memory and you change, we think, synaptic connections or connections between neurons, glial cells are there and probably are doing important things. One specific example I can give from our own work is that there are these fascinating molecules called neuromodulators. These are things like dopamine and serotonin and other things that can take your nervous system and when certain cells release them, really transform how it works. And norepinephrine is a very well-known one that's important for focused attention or memory formation and retrieval. And so for the longest period of time, people believed that the way that neuromodulators work is they are released by one neuron, they go and that chemical binds to another neuron, and then it exerts the change and you get the effect. But what we found actually is that in some cases, those neuromodulators are actually released by a neuron, they bind to a glial cell, and then information flows through a glial cell that then changes the circuit. So probably in the future, we're going to need to reassess the notion that the neurons are the ones that are doing all the communicating and the glia are just there for support. It's very clear in at least this one case that glia are also really important for changing how that circuit fires. And so, for example, we can block the ability of glial cells to do that in a fruit fly, which is the main organism that we study. And we can show that when you can't do that glial signaling, the flies can't learn and remember that a particular odor was associated with a sugar reward. So they're also going to be part of the signaling axis in the brain.
Let's talk to Jamie in Medford. Go ahead, Jamie.
Good morning, Milt. I would like to ask your guest a couple of questions, and I'll take the answers off. I'll listen to them on the radio. The first one is, my mother has multiple sclerosis. What's the latest update on how that research is going for a cure? And the second one is, this might be a little hypothetical, but what's your take on nanotechnology and the blood-brain barrier in the brain? And I'll, like I said, Milt, I'll take these on the radio. Goodbye.
Thank you, Jay.
Okay. Thank you. So the latest on multiple sclerosis, this... So multiple sclerosis would not be my point of expertise, but if you could give me his contact information, I could certainly get him in touch with somebody. Multiple sclerosis, at the moment, people are still striving to understand. So there's a couple different phases. There's the relapsing, remitting phase early on, and then there's a chronic progressive phase. And I think we're gaining a better understanding of the sorts of changes that happen in the brain. But the latest, I think anti-inflammatories are still the most prominent thing that a clinician would prescribe, but I'm going to defer that to clinical colleagues and let them answer that. With nanotechnology, this is a sort of broad area that, again, is not my point of expertise, but there are things about nanoparticles and or coated particles that allow them to get into the brain in interesting ways, and so people are beginning to think about how to use those as delivery mechanisms, either for the sorts of molecules that might do gene therapy or drugs. So that's an interesting question. I probably am not qualified to give the latest on nanotechnology.
We have about a minute left. Let me ask a question of, do you find it difficult to explain the work that you folks do? It's pretty highly scientific. Do you find it difficult to explain that to just normal people who aren't involved in the sciences? Or do you have specific programs at the Volum where you can sort of ratchet this down and help people understand?
Yeah, so it is... Sometimes when you get into the minutiae of the experiments that we're doing in the lab, it can get a bit mind-numbing for a non-scientist, because to understand why it's so exciting, you need to appreciate the details. I am a very strong believer in the notion that we as biomedical research scientists need to do a better job explaining why what we do is interesting. I think that the key for us is that the brain is an absolutely fascinating organism. It's a massive circuit that allows us to interact with the sensory world and do really tremendous things. We need to remind people how exciting that is and show them in very specific terms how we can study it and begin to understand it.
Dr. Mark Freeman has joined us this morning. He's the incoming director of the Volum Institute at Oregon Health Sciences University. Mark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.